you, Sister Valerie and team. That last song they were singing is very powerful and really helps us get into our theme tonight. The message is called Pushing Back Evil. And one of the key themes in the book of Esther, we're in chapter 8 tonight, are the great reversals that take place in the book. And when you think of the second coming, there is no event in history that will give the greatest pushback against evil and reverse things that we think are irreversible. There's a lot of things that we see in life that we think could never be changed, and God can change anything. As we're going into chapter 8 tonight, you might remember the setting from last week, how Haman had set up these gallows to hang Mordecai on, and he's going off to a banquet, hoping that things are going to start to turn for the better for him, and they only get worse. And he ends up hanging on the very gallows he had made for Mordecai. And so things don't go well for him. We read that the king's anger subsided. And you might wonder, well, why was Xerxes really so angry? Was it because of his sense of justice was somehow offended? It was really his pride. King Xerxes is a very, very proud man. It's one of the themes in the book of Esther. And as though the author of this book is constantly poking a little bit humorously at this massive pride of the king and how God can humble any king. It seems to go with the territory. Nebuchadnezzar had great pride. Xerxes has great pride. And so we see the wounded pride of Haman led to him wanting all Jews dead. And then the wounded pride of Xerxes end up with Xerxes wanting Haman dead. He must die. That's the setting tonight. We ease now into chapter 8, verses 1 and 2. And we read, the same day, King Xerxes gave Queen Esther the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Herodotus tells us that this was common practice when a traitor committed an act of treachery. His estate, after he was put to death, would go back to the state. So he just gives it to Esther, his wife. And Mordecai came into the presence of the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had reclaimed from Haman, and presented it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed him over Haman's estate. Now, the king is fixing things, but he hasn't yet fixed the main problem for the Jews in the empire. Hasn't even touched that yet. But what we're seeing now is now the reversal of destinies. Haman's destiny already taken care of, but the destiny of the Jews, of Mordecai especially, is going to reverse. And we see Xerxes gives Haman's estate to Esther. Then he gives his signet ring to Mordecai. This is significant. Mordecai is now being elevated very, very highly. The signet ring is like the signature of the king. It's like having, you go to the Olympics and you get, you know, Justin Trudeau's credit card. Go ahead, spend the taxes. Use that credit card. And that's what it is here. It's the authentication of the king. You have authority to do a lot. Esther's relationship with Mordecai now is being restructured as she is the one who empowers Mordecai. She gives Haman's estate to Mordecai. So Mordecai gets the signet ring. He gets the estate of Haman. He's going to be in Haman's position. She also now takes the lead on the decree crisis. She takes it head on. We see this in verses 3 and 4. We're going to see Esther's leadership really rise tonight. Verse 3, Esther again pleaded with the king, falling at his feet and weeping. She begged him to put an end to the evil plan of Haman the Agagite, which he had devised against the Jews. Then the king extended the gold scepter to Esther, and she arose and stood before him. The gold scepter, you know the power of that symbolism. You could only come into the king's presence if he extended the scepter, even if you were married to him. And basically he's saying, make your plea. And so we see the bowing, the begging, the tears are part of a powerful plea she will make to the king about what was most needed. He hadn't taken care of what was most needed. He gives Haman's estate away. He gives the signet ring away. But we got a massive crisis in the empire. He hasn't dealt with that. She will plead with regards to that problem. She's asking for justice. Verse 5, she says, if it pleases the king. She's so careful with her words. She knows the culture. And if he regards me with favor and he thinks it the right thing to do, justice. And if he is pleased with me, let an order be written overruling the dispatches that Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, devised and wrote to destroy the Jews in all the king's provinces. For how can I bear to see disaster fall on my people? How can I bear to see the destruction of my family? Now, Esther's plea cannot be granted. The law of the Medes and Persians is irrevocable. Even the king cannot overturn his own law. And this was a pride thing in the 100-year-old Persian culture. It doesn't exist anymore. But they put laws out there that could not be changed. I guess they're trying to be like God. Only God's law is truly immutable because God is immutable. Verse 7. King Xerxes replied to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, because Haman attacked the Jews, I have given his estate to Esther, and they have impaled him, that's Haman, on the pole he set up. Now write another decree in the king's name, in behalf of the Jews, as seems best to you, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For no document written in the king's name and sealed with his ring can be revoked. So Xerxes here empowers Esther and Mordecai to neutralize the first decree with a second decree that has equal authority and equal force. So they can't abolish the first decree, they can only issue a second one. And now things are being set up. Verse 9, at once the royal secretaries were summoned on the 23rd day of the third month, the month of Sivan. Interestingly, exactly 70 days from Haman's decree. It's just an interesting number in the Bible. They wrote out all Mordecai's orders to the Jews. So the Jews are first in the first decree of Haman. The Jews were only mentioned for destruction. This letter is addressed to them now. And to the satraps and governors and nobles of the 127 provinces. Look at the geography stretching from India to Kush. That's India in the east and the northeast, all the way down to Africa. That's how big this empire was. These orders were written in the script of each province and the language of each people, and also to the Jews in their own script and language. Mordecai wrote in the name of King Xerxes, sealed the dispatches with the king's signet ring, and sent them by mounted couriers who rode fast horses, especially bred for the king. And time had to be considered. 127 provinces, a certain day was set for the destruction of the Jews, so this was done hastily. And so like in chapter 3, verse 12, where you had Haman's decree, the same elaborate, multilingual, scribal squad comes out and they write this new decree in all these languages, and it's addressed first to the Jews and then to the leaders. The evil plan can't be canceled, but this new decree is to reverse what was done in the first one. It's empowering the targeted people. And the message goes out with speed, royal steeds. It's a very powerful scene, if you will. We continue reading verse 11. It says, the king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate the armed men of any nationality or province who might attack them, and their women and children. and to plunder the property of their enemies. The day appointed for the Jews to do this in all the provinces of King Xerxes was the 13th day of the 12th month of the month Adar. There's only one day they could do this. Verse 13, a copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. Now, this wasn't permission to launch a civil war, but a civil war could come out of this. It wasn't permission to do what we'd call a preemptive strike. It was permission for self-protection and for defense on the day that they were supposed to be attacked. Haman had set a day by casting lots. On that same day, the Jews were simply allowed to defend themselves in all 127 provinces. They were allowed to organize themselves, to train, and then to defend themselves. So we read in verse 14, the couriers riding the royal horses went out spurred on by the king's command, and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. So Haman's edict of death initially brought great mourning, fasting and prayer, weeping and wailing. You might remember the picture of Mordecai. It says that he was covered in sackcloth and ashes and he was wailing publicly. And now we're going to see this other incredible reversal. Look how he's dressed now. When Mordecai left the king's presence, he was wearing royal garments of blue and white, a large crown of gold, and a purple robe of fine linen. And the city of Susa held a joyous celebration. For the Jews, it was a time of happiness, joy, gladness, and honor. In every province and in every city to which the edict of the king came, there was joy and gladness among the Jews, with feasting and celebrating, and many people of other nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them. So Mordecai, who was condemned, rises up to take the position of the very man that condemned him to death. Another reversal. The Jews themselves, who were mourning and fasting and weeping, now because of this decree reversal, are having a time of joy, gladness, fasting, celebrating. And you know, it's a little bit like what it should be when we have the Lord's table. There's been a great reversal in our lives, and it should be a time of joy, of remembering what we've escaped from. Now, possibly the people of the empire could see dimly that some kind of power was at work helping the Jews out of their predicament. They see what happened to Haman. They see Mordecai being elevated, and maybe, we don't know because they don't have the same belief system as the Jews have, but somehow they could see there's something going on here. We better be careful with this people. And it says they feared the Jews, and some of them became Jews themselves. It's very interesting development. Now, does the decree of Mordecai, as I read it, seem overly harsh to you when you read it? And I softly emphasized the words women and children. You probably felt, gee, that seems like really harsh. What's going on here? And you'd have to go back to the decree written by Haman and compare it to this one. So that one's back in chapter 3, verse 13. What you would find is they're meeting a deadly force with deadly force in the same measure with the same words. It's exactly the same wording, exact same decree. And so that tells us a little something. There's justice here, but it's perhaps a strong message being sent throughout the empire to say, don't do this. What you intend to do to us, we have the power. We've been legally allowed to defend ourselves. We will do to you what you do to us. It is Old Testament. It is eye for eye, tooth for tooth. They're the exact same words, but we still have difficulty with it, don't we? You know, when you think of holy war in the Old Testament in general, you read the book of Joshua, you read the book of Judges, and you see God commanding, and it's God who commands it, all-out destruction of certain people groups. And you try and square that with what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount in chapter 5, love your enemies. And say, what's going on here? We have to remind ourselves of a few things. When you're dealing with a nation state and commands for a nation state, it's not the same thing, and you can't transfer that over or take the words of Jesus and transfer that back to Israel. And so Jesus speaking to individuals in the church, it's not the same as how a nation state protects its people and protects itself. It's just not the same. So it's not apples it's apples and oranges. They're not the same thing. We also have to remind ourselves of what happened at the cross. When Jesus died at the cross, holy war was fought there. God was fighting evil and sin at the cross in the body of Jesus Christ. The penalty was paid for and justice was satisfied. And Esther fits in the Old Testament context of holy war and God's redemption story. It's right there. It's in the Old Testament. We have to remember that. We have to remember also, what else could Mordecai do? There was a planned genocide that was enshrined in the decree of the Persians, and somehow that had to be stopped. And so he issues another strong decree in the same language, in the same words, to try and stop the first one. It is brutal sounding, but it's interesting to see also there's a much bigger picture going on. These strong words of chapter 8, verse 11 are exactly the same words in the law in Deuteronomy 25, verse 17, about the same people, where when the Jews were coming out of Egypt, going into the promised land, the Amalekites were waiting for them and waylaid them on the way and attacked the people that were at the end of the movement of people and just wiped them out and had a perpetual hatred for Israel and sought its destruction. And God commanded and said, do not forget what the Amalekites did. And he commanded for them to be blotted out. It's very harsh. Centuries later, through Samuel to Saul, the command is given. And Saul now is to fulfill the command of God, to totally wipe out this people. Now, it would seem that Haman the Agagite, who comes from these people, Haman is from the line of the king of the Amalekites, that maybe he's trying to reverse the very thing that God has decreed for his people and trying to do to the Jews what God is being commanded for his people. We're not sure, but it seems to be echoing down. Mordecai's using the same words, Haman's using the same words, and it all goes back to this long story with the Amalekite people. Without the cross, we'd still be fighting holy war in the world. Holy war should end at the cross. And Jesus brought it to an end when he said, it is finished. Nations have the right to defend themselves, but not holy war. And every nation does defend itself. And so that's something that I think we would agree on. I want to end our time thinking a little bit about Esther and her growth. Remember when Esther was so passive and she was kind of thrown into the harem of Xerxes, the king, and she just is kind of going along with things. And now we see Esther actually leading. She's giving leadership. And there she is, strong. It seems like she's weak when she's pleading, begging on her knees with tears, but it's actually strength. She's going before the most powerful man of the world, and she's daring to challenge the decree of the Persians. She's very wise. She understands the culture of Persia. She understands the heart of her husband, the king. She knows his pride. She knows that he actually was part of writing the decree, and she never crosses the line of offending him and somehow accusing him of wrongdoing. Very, very wise. At the right time, she reveals Mordecai's identity, that he is her uncle, in fact. And so this comes out at the right time. Esther's good relationship with her husband pays off. Imagine if she had been like Vashti. Remember how Vashti was with King Xerxes? And now she's coming to plead something big. And the sense you get in the text from the scholars is that King Xerxes was kind of at the end of his patience. And it sort of comes through in the text. But she pushes as far as she can push, asks as much as she could ask, does it with great wisdom and great courage. the good relationship she has with her husband, now it can become a point of leverage. She's able to leverage on behalf of her people and her uncle Mordecai. A couple things, too, that we could also end with. You see the danger of plotting. So you read about that in the book of Proverbs, that it's dangerous to dig a pit for somebody else. You end up falling into it. And Haman created this plot to destroy Mordecai, and exactly what he planned for Mordecai falls upon him, exactly. And it tells us also about the evil plans of larger nations, of people groups. And you look at history, and I was reading Charles Swindoll on his commentary in the book of Esther, and he had in this chapter this line that all walls eventually fall down. And he talks about the evil edicts that people write and enshrine and chisel in stone, and some of them seem like it'll never change. It can never change. This cannot be reversed. And ones that come to mind are the law of Roe versus Wade back in the 1970s, and millions of innocent babes have perished because of that evil law. And it just seems like, well, it's so part of the culture that could never be reversed, could never be changed. And there are other things in our culture in the West that are like that. It's just part of who we are. It's unimaginable that we'd ever take on that fight and try to reverse that. I think of the hatred between North Korea and South Korea going back to the 1960s. And the only thing keeping those two peoples from an all-out war and total destruction is that military group in the middle called the DMZ that holds everything in check. More recently, the North Sudan and the South Sudan and the hatred that is there. And we could multiply many, many things like this. The things that we think could never, ever change, that law can't change. And maybe personally in your life, there's something in your life that you see that, or maybe feel, this could never change in my life. My life situation could never change. The situation I'm in at work, the situation I'm in my family could never be reversed. This chapter tells us God can reverse anything. God is in charge. He is the Lord. And this evil empire, well, completely changed. The Babylonian Empire completely changed. God changes things. I'd like to end tonight in a time of prayer. I want to challenge you to get into a couple groups of three, four, and five, that you take on a couple of these, well, that could never change issues. Maybe you would take on the Roe versus Wade law, the abortion law, in Canada, in the U.S., in Europe, and you would pray against that. You would ask God Almighty to reverse that. Or the situation between North Korea and South Korea. God, reverse that. And maybe there's others that I can't think of that you would ask the Lord to reverse. It's perhaps a thing in your own life, a personal situation in your life. Lord, you're the only one that can reverse this difficult thing that I'm in, this impossible thing that I have to live with. So we're going to end right now. I'm going to ask you to get in groups of three, four. If you're uncomfortable praying out loud with somebody, pray silently. But somebody be brave enough to pray. Let's do some reversing in the world now. So get in the little groups. Maybe take a minute or two and identify yourself to each other. Hi, my name is. And begin praying in the Spirit. Let's move. Let's make some noise. And then I'll close in prayer in a few minutes.